Marilynne Robinson was last here to talk about her novel Gilead, which then went on to win a Pulitzer. We can only hope for the same. That's come out 3 years later. She has returned to the same setting as her previous work, and yet this novel is quite different. It's called Home. It's been hailed by critics as reminiscent of the most soulful and moving work of masters like Willa Cather, William Maxwell, and James Agee. Vera Strauss is the publisher, and I'm pleased to welcome Marilynne Robinson back to the show. Hello.
Hello.
When did you know that you would return to Gilead, Iowa for another book? Was that something you had in mind all along?
No, absolutely not. I started working on a book that I had intended to write before I wrote Gilead, actually, a nonfiction book. I was working on it, and somehow in my peripheral vision, the characters from Gilead kept, you know, being active, living their lives. And so I thought, why suppress this, you know? And so I put aside what I was doing and began writing this novel.
And I've talked to writers about this before. Some writers are perfectly happy to put the characters to rest when they complete a book, but others say, you know, they're still there. Mm-hmm. They were talking to me while I was writing that earlier book, and I couldn't get rid of them, and so I had to go back to them. Were there certain things that you hadn't addressed with the earlier book that you realized you wanted to talk about?
Well, the character of Jack, first of all, I think, because I realized that I had a different impression of him than many readers seem to be having. He was a much fuller character in my mind than he seemed to be for many people. And frankly, I like Jack. I'm fond of him. I wanted to give him his moment as I experience it, at least.
But the main character here is Robert Boughton. In fact, Gilead dealt with the aging Reverend John Ames, and it was in the form of a letter to his son. He's a minor character here, but you didn't get rid of him. You just made him into a minor character.
Mm-hmm.
Now his longtime best friend, the former pastor Robert Boughton, but the story here is told through the eyes of his daughter Glory.
Yes,
and she has this very compelling voice. Was that something that you had from the start?
Yes, I knew that I had to look at that world compassionately, but with a degree of detachment too, you know. And she was that way for me in Gilead, although she appears very briefly there.
Well, what determines whether you tell a story with a woman's voice or a man's voice? Housekeeping, of course, was a woman's voice, mm-hmm. but then you had a man's voice in Gilead.
I have no idea what determines
that. What happens?
Exactly. What's inside my head.
And you start right away with it because some writers have say they started with one third person, then they go to first person. They're telling the story through one character, then they realize that's not the way to go, and they find another character.
I have never done that. I think that I write fewer novels than most people do, and I write them under perhaps a different kind of impulsion than other people do. The voice of the novel is the first thing, really, that comes to me, and everything seems to depend on it.
Well, there were over two decades between Housekeeping and Gilead, and just 3 years between Gilead and Home, so are you writing faster or fewer drafts?
No. The 24 years, I've written every one of my books in probably under 2 years. I write novels quickly, oddly enough. But I can generalize now that I have three. But in any case, the time between I spent learning about things I wanted to learn about and living a very quiet and content civilian life where I was just able to, inquire into things and change my mind in a way.
So you're not like the writers who say, well, I just every day I have to write no matter what.
No.
Home is a kind of return of the prodigal child story, only there isn't one. There are two siblings who mm-hmm. return. Glory is been disillusioned with her life, comes home out of a sense of duty, and her brother Jack, whose absence has been a mystery, and so is his sudden reappearance. And they're very different characters. Was it hard at times to reconcile the two and empathize with each of them?
Nope. No.
You love all your characters?
I love all my characters.
Even the ones who aren't always so nice?
Absolutely.
Do you think that you have to understand them to write about them? For example, you felt that readers didn't truly understand an important character in Gilead, and you felt it was necessary to make them understand him.
Or just to open up the character further. I don't know if you can actually understand people. Therefore, I don't know if it's plausible in literature, in writing, to understand characters. I think that my interest in them is in the fact that I myself don't entirely understand them.
You also, this book is very much about the concept of home.
Mm-hmm.
It's appropriate that you named it home. Glory, you write, had dreamed of another kind of home for herself, which she would call a real home, one filled with her own husband and children. Instead, she muses, home, what kind of place could there be on earth, and why did it seem to them all like exile?
Yes.
So home can be both a place where you feel at home and a place where you don't feel at home.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What are we to make of this household where people's lives have been so frayed, and yet religion is the family business. Religion is supposed to be the thing that makes people feel more comfortable about themselves.
I think in theory that might be true. But, you know, when you look at even Old Testament stories about people like Eli and Samuel and so on, great prophets who have children who are, you know, really rapscallions, you know. I mean, it happens, the Bible, if you take that as normative, which they would have, and read the stories, there's no precedent in it for a good father reliably producing a good son, for example, you know.
My guest is Marilynne Robinson. Her latest novel, Home, is published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Not much happens plot-wise in this novel, and family members rehash the same questions that have perplexed them over and over again. And yet, as one critic noted, we feel a need to read it so compulsively, as avidly as we might read a detective thriller. I'm sure you were very pleased by that.
Absolutely.
But you don't feel pressured to come up with a complicated plot?
My bias is so strongly in favor of character and also perception, you know, that I have a sort of prejudice against plot. I consider it a sort of clattering machine, you know, that obscures things that are actually of greater interest in many, many cases.
So it gets in the way sometimes.
Absolutely.
You set home in the mid-50s again. That period, obviously, is a period that is very important in your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Why the 50s? Most people think of the 50s as, either if you want to think negatively, as the time of apathy and McCarthyism, and then if you want to think of it positively, as a time before all of the craziness that the 60s brought were forced on this country.
Well, it was the time before the civil rights movement that I think is one of the most important aspects of it. It's a cusp in American cultural life. There was a long period, I mean, you know, the period after the war, when people sort of felt as if things could fall into a sort of positive normality, I think, even despite atom bombs and all the rest of it.
But the country, the economy was booming.
Yes, it was.
And New York, for example, which you don't write about, but New York was considered at that point now the greatest city in the world.
Yes, it's true. And I think, you know, of course, I don't write from that perspective. I write from the perspective of people who would have felt that they were fairly much on the fringes of the world, as I did at that time. But I think that the fact that in the 50s it was still possible for people who considered themselves to be, you know, virtuous citizens of a good civilization were about to come up with this fantastic challenge, you know, and basically assault on what had been assumed before. The struggle between honesty and hypocrisy in human affairs is always engaged and strenuous and so on, and always interesting, I think, because the impulse toward the wrong choice is always very strong.
Now, the civil rights had a religious component, but do you see the 50s as a cusp period for a religious belief in this country as well?
I think it was. I think that, again, in the post-war, there was a lot of building of churches and lots of congregations grew and all that sort of thing.
We added under God to the Pledge of Allegiance.
Exactly, exactly.
And we talked about godless communism.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. I don't really claim to understand what the religious thought in that period was, but there were great theologians who were active in that period, which I don't think, frankly, we can say at the moment. I think religion had a lot of authority, and in a way, it prepared an audience for Martin Luther King. He could speak to them in language that was very authoritative to them, you know. And I'm afraid that has been, in a certain sense, distorted and corrupted. We can't use religious arguments anymore to make a clear case for looking after the poor, for example, which is a bizarre change, in my opinion.
Would you read a bit from the book for us, please?
Sure.
My guest is Marilyn Robinson. Her latest novel is Home, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
This is from a passage where Jack and Gloria are beginning to approach each other, beginning to feel like allies in this household. More often, as the days went by, Jack sought her out to talk with her. And when the talk drifted into silence, sometimes he would smile at her as if to say, "You and I, of all people, here of all places, killing time for lack of anything else to do with it." A stranger might look at her that way, past the tedium of their situation, past the accidental companionship that came with their whiling it out together, to let her know in a decorous and impersonal way how glad he was she was there. And sometimes when they were working in the garden or doing the dishes, she would notice that he had drawn back to watch her appraisingly, as if he had suddenly dropped every assumption about her, as if she were someone who figured in an intention of his and about whom he realized he knew nothing to be relied upon or nothing that mattered, someone he must consider again carefully. She did not remember from her childhood the habit he had now of running the tip of his tongue across his lower lip. But she thought she did remember that estrangement of his gaze, that look of urgent calculation, a sharply attentive calm. It could only be fear, and she wanted to say, "You can trust me," but that is what they had always told him, and he laughed and pretended to believe them, and wished to believe them, she was sure, and never did. Her father always said that loneliness of his, and when she saw it in him now, she felt lonely, even abandoned for the moment it lasted, until the banter of comfort and familiarity took up again. He'd say, "Hey, chum," to coax her out of her thoughts. They were indeed very sad thoughts, as his must have been too. And he would smile with fellow feeling, her bemused and improbable companion.
Marilyn Robinson reading from Home, her latest novel. Was it that loneliness that people didn't get in Gilead?
Yes. And also, I think that often people whose relationship to conventional society is somewhat oblique, they don't actually trust their own impulses fully. You know, they can't defend themselves against people who they know are, in a certain sense, more answering to norms of various kinds than they are. Jack is lonely, lonely for a life he can't sustain and can't defend.
You talked about learning things in the intervening years between housekeeping and Gilead. What did you learn?
Oh, my goodness. I read all sorts of things. I read lots of theology, lots of history, Gilead and Home are both products of the fact that I just decided I needed to know more about the history of the Middle West and launched on this strange...
I mean, if you were writing about it, you might as well know something about it.
It went the other way, actually.
But you could write about something just through your own personal experience of it.
Well, what happened was I moved into the Middle West, where I had never planned to live there. I had the prejudice that most people do against the Middle West, and I thought, I have to know something about this place in order to you know, to be at home here. So I started reading about the early settlement and found out it has this splendid history as in terms of, you know, social reform and abolitionism and all the rest. And I read that because it was interesting. I read as much that was contemporaneous with the period as I could find, more or less. And then it was after that that Gilead came to me and was set in, you know, within that world. But I didn't do the research for the sake of the novel.
It's interesting that the Midwest had that history and has now inspired books like Thomas Frank's Whatever Happened to Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Midwest has changed a lot over the years. Is there a new book in the works?
Well, I'm returning to that book that home would not let me finish. And I, you know, who knows, maybe it will germinate another novel and be put off again. But that's my intention now.
Or maybe we'll have that nonfiction work.
Yes.
Home is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. My great thanks to Marilynne Robinson for being our guest today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So it was good to see you.
Thank you.